Hello and welcome to another episode of Money Control Macro Minutes. In this episode, we have with us Pranjul Bhandari, Chief Economist with HSBC in India. Now, Pranjul is one of those rare private sector economists who has had extensive public policy experience. She has served in the erstwhile Planning Commission. She has worked in the Finance Ministry. She's also a resident. She also has a resident fellowship from the International Monetary Fund. So not only public policy in India, but also multilateral public policy is something she has worked on. And that makes Pranjul Bhandari the perfect guest for our continuing theme of what the upcoming budget could bring for the economy. So Pranjul, welcome to Money Control Macro Minutes.
Thank you, Arup. It's great to be on your show.
Yeah. So before we got onto this podcast, I read two of your recent reports, one from today morning and one from Monday earlier in the week. So let's start with the one which came earlier in the week. You have made a very interesting point that the combination of risk-averse banks in India because of the high risk of NPAs and all, and a pandemic-led elevated financial savings is leading to a situation where there is a slippage in India's domestic savings abroad at a time when these savings are needed for recovery at home. So for our listeners, would you explain this whole theory and why is it a problem for the country?
Yes, sure. So, you know, the point we're making is exactly what you said, that we think that the finite domestic savings that we have in India, a lot of it is slipping away abroad. And I'll tell you why I think so. You know, let's rewind back to 2019, when we first started talking about, you know, how risk-averse banks had become and credit growth had fallen. You know, what we saw was that banks sitting on so much of debt were not ready to give out loans as easily as before. And if banks stopped intermediating, then what we found was there wasn't enough funds for investment and investment growth was slowing. Now, once investment growth was slowing, all the investment-related imports were also slowing. And when imports were slowing, our current account deficit was narrowing. There was too much of a BOP surplus. And then in order to keep the rupee from appreciating, because, you know, at a time, anyway, investment is slowing, you don't even want the rupee to appreciate. You know, that will really hurt your exports. So to keep the rupee from appreciating, the central bank went out there and bought a lot of dollars. In 2019, it bought $45 billion. Now, what does the RBI do with these dollars, with these FX reserves? It invests them in things like US Treasury bill, Euro bonds, bonds which are issued by the Japanese government. And therefore, to cut a very long story short, risk aversion in India's banks was leading to the slippage of our savings abroad, you know, investing in other bonds. Move to from 2019 to 2020, and we saw that because of the lockdown, financial savings actually only increased. In fact, RBI has this amazing number on how household financial savings rose from 10% of GDP to 24% of GDP in just one quarter. And what was happening to this whole mountain of savings? Investment had not picked up, banks were not lending, BOP surplus was strong. And just to keep the rupee from appreciating again in a slowdown, the RBI bought about $70 billion you know, worth of FX reserves. Again, all of this money was being invested abroad, especially at a time when we needed it in India.
All right. So what is the way out of this? How do you make the banking system less risk averse at a time when the RBI has itself said that from September 2020 to September 2021, the level of NPAs could almost double because there are fears that because of the pandemic, NPAs will rise. So how, what is the way out of this? How do you make the banking system less risk averse?
Yes, I think there's no one solution. I think it has to be a package. A couple of things is the fact that I think we have to reinstate the insolvency and bankruptcy code. What the pandemic has done is that it has left a lot of loser sectors and a lot of winner sectors. And the IBC is the only way we reallocate resources from sectors that are not working towards the sectors that are working and, you know, take care of corporate stress through that. So that is one thing. The second is make recapitalization funds available upfront for public sector banks. I think that should be done in priority. And over the medium term, find a way in which you, you know, you reduce all the pressures that you put on India's public sector banks, you know, privatization, disinvestment, what have you. But we have to reduce the mandate that the government has on the public sector banks.
Okay. Isn't there a sort of an exhaustion or sort of saturation regarding the whole point of capitalization? It has been happening since 2016, round after round after round of banking capitalization. So a question that any interested party or any layman would ask is, where does this stop? Where does this recap of public sector banks stop?
You know, the best optimal solution would be privatization of a lot of these banks.
Yeah, true,
and then you don't
true.
Then the government doesn't have to recap them, right? Mm-hmm. So until we are not getting the first best solution, we have to make do with the second best solution while keeping in mind that the dialogue for the first best is continuing. And that's where I think you have to, you know, recapitalize banks. And to be honest, Arup, I don't think that in previous rounds of bank recapitalization, a lot of funds have been put forth. It has always been a small fraction of what was generally demanded or expected.
True, that's true. Now coming to the report that you had sent out this morning, you have made a very pertinent point that there were fears of a post-festive season rise in cases because of increased mobility and almost no restrictions in the country. And yet, fortunately, that has not happened so far. And you spoke about there going ahead, there are four rotations that the government and the policymakers need to be mindful of. So if you could just explain them for our listeners.
Yes, sure. So, you know, India's economic experience has been a little different from other countries. Mm-hmm. And I think one way is what's really happening with pandemic cases. Mm-hmm. I think we are one of the few countries in which mobility is rising, mm-hmm. and yet new pandemic cases is actually falling. In True. Some sense, we've broken that vicious link.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why the rebound that we saw in the September quarter mm-hmm. has continued since. Mm-hmm. In fact, our latest number shows that, activity is at 94% of pre-pandemic levels, you know, which is extremely high in such a short span of time. Yes. And interestingly, I think this excitement is going to continue over the next couple of months. And that's where I wanted to actually highlight a few big shifts that may happen. Mm-hmm. One big shift could be from goods demand to services demand. You know, as a vaccine comes into play and the pent-up demand for high-touch services could go up, goods have already reached pre-pandemic levels, but services demand are still 30% shy of pre-pandemic levels. So a huge catch-up can happen there.
By high-touch, you mean restaurants and hospitality and these sectors, right?
Hospitality. Even health, education, tourism, all the services where you have to sort of meet other people. My only problem with this rotation, the shift is that I worry about services inflation. And if that takes hold, then the RBI will have to become very cautious. The second rotation that, you know, we've been speaking about is move from rural demand to urban demand. Last year, the stars had aligned for rural India. In a sense, a lot of spending happened there by the government. Rains were good. There were a lot of laborers. But now, slowly, as urban activity is restarting, I think a lot of this labor will return to urban centers. Because at the end of the day, urban incomes are about 2.5 times that of rural incomes. So this big shift of economic activity from rural to urban India is the other big shift that could happen. Again, policymakers will have to be careful because some of these people will find that their urban jobs don't exist anymore. And they'll have to stay back in rural India. So I think the government will have to ensure that there's enough NREGA, other social welfare schemes to look after these people. Of course, we also talk about two other shifts, but those two other shifts will probably not happen as automatically as the first two. Mm-hmm. One is we are hoping that there is wider dispersion of income and welfare. What we found in 2020 is a huge amount of inequality. Mm-hmm. Large firms and high earners have done fairly well through the pandemic, but not, small firms. And it's the small firms that make up 85% of the labor force.
The MSMEs.
Now, the rich have gotten richer. Correct. That's right. The rich have gotten richer. They have accumulated a lot of saving. And as they are spending it, we are seeing a huge increase in growth. But at some point, that will get exhausted. And then we'll have to look at the rest of the labor force. And there we are finding a lot of stress. In fact, the CMIE database shows that there are 15 million lesser people employed today than the same time last year. So I think another big challenge for the government is that you have to keep social welfare spending for this group on.
All right. And the last point is about consumption to investment shift, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right. You know, the final point and a shift that we hope happens is a move from consumption to investment, because we know that investment is the only way in which you can create, you know, sustainable jobs over the medium term. Unfortunately, that may not happen automatically, particularly at a time when there's so much of excess capacity in the economy. And again, the government will have to take a big step here, you know, by putting some capex funds out there and hoping that it crowds in private investment over time. So Arup, you know, just to sort of summarize across all of this, this could be a year of big shifts. You know, some shifts will happen automatically. Some will need more support from the government. But generally, the role of the government is going to be quite enhanced in 2021. In some sense, even more important than it was back in 2020.
No, you're absolutely right, because the finance minister herself, throughout December, throughout last month, she had hinted constantly at various public events that there will be a huge capex outlay and the government is gearing up for public spending surge. So that was her, and you know, that's the indication she gave. But as such, what are your 3 or 4 expectations from the budget? What is it that the finance minister needs to do when she rises up in Lok Sabha on the first of February, and she announces the budget?
Yeah, you know, one thing is that, you know, consolidate the fiscal deficit. Now we know that the fiscal deficit has gone up to about 7% of GDP by our estimate in FY21. So you need to bring it down, but bring it down gradually. Don't cut expenditure aggressively, you know, in the FY22 budget. Particularly, don't cut in expenditure on social welfare schemes or on capex, because both of these are extremely important to ensure that the recovery we are seeing is sustained. So that's one. And you know, there's actually some good news here. You know, because it obviously sounds very challenging, then bring down the fiscal deficit, but don't bring down expenditure. How do you do that? There are a few helping hands out there. I think the biggest helping hand is going to come from tax revenues. You know, with all of these large firms doing well, there has been some formalization of demand. And because many of these companies are under the tax net, tax revenues could increase quite a lot. And we could see high tax buoyancy in FY22. And that could help fund, you know, both keeping expenditure high and also bringing down the fiscal deficit slowly. Of course, the other one is disinvestment. It's a really good time to do disinvestment when your capital markets are so buoyant. You know, it's been a disappointment in the past. So I'm not pinning too many hopes on that yet. But tax buoyancy can really help you this year. So my request is that, you know, don't cut expenditure dramatically right now. My second expectation is that take whatever steps you can to strengthen your banks. We've just discussed this. You know, provide the recapitalization money that will be needed. Bring back the IBC gradually into play. My third expectation is just, you know, the economic environment. Try to have an economic environment in which there's certainty on the tax front. There's certainty on the policymaking front. I think that is very important to bring back investment into play. And finally, press on with reforms. I think now is the time. We have a great opportunity to become a part of, you know, some of the trade chains across the world, supply chains across the world. So don't mess it up there. I think last couple of years, every budget, we have increased import tariffs on various goods. You know, as a trade economist will tell you that an import tariff acts as an export tax. So try to avoid that. Instead of import tariffs, focus on export promotion.
True. All right. Just one last couple of observations. In fact, when you spoke about the first shift, that a shift from goods to services demand could lead to an inflationary pressure. And we have seen throughout 2020, the calendar year, only 2 months, March and December, we had retail inflation below the Monetary Policy Committee's target range of 4±2%. And December was good, of course, in terms of inflation coming down. However, how do you see it going ahead? How do you see inflation, especially because by April, the Monetary Policy Committee will have to be given new targets. So do you think the current 4±2% target range should stay, or should they be given a more flexible or probably a higher target?
Yeah, Arup, I'm glad you asked this question. So, you know, 2020 was a year of high food inflation, and sort of created all the problem. Thankfully, by the time we reached December, we saw a huge disinflation in vegetable prices, and inflation has come off a bit. You know, there was also some favorable base effect at play, and I think by March, inflation could go up a little bit. But generally, I think the food problem may not persist in 2021. Mm-hmm. My problem is that a new problem can come in 2021, and that is services inflation. Yes. Yes. You know, as a vaccine comes into play, mm-hmm. you know, as the richer keep consuming, we know that the richer in India consume more services than mm-hmm. goods. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, we will see services inflation come back in. You know, this had taken us by surprise back in 2010, when suddenly services inflation had come in, and 3 years it was not budging. You know, it was high and it was sticky. So that is a scenario, you know, you really would like to avoid at this point. And I think that can be a problem. That can be the key problem for 2021. How do you deal with services inflation? Now, as to your point on inflation targets, I think one of our best reforms so far has been, you know, introducing the flexible inflation targeting regime. And I think what is important in that regime is that you don't keep tinkering with the targets all the time, mm-hmm. because that itself dilutes the efficacy of the regime. And I'm hoping that, you know, when it is up for review in the next couple of months, the targets are not tinkered with. Right. To be very honest, it's not, it's a flexible regime, 4% plus minus 2. So you can go up to 6 in a pandemic year, and nobody is really, you know, punishing you for that. Thankfully, we have got inflation under 6 in December, and in the next 12 months, we expect it to remain under 6. So, you know, I don't think it's going to interfere in any way. And I think we should hold on to an inflation targeting regime and the targets.
So you were saying that for the calendar year 2021, on an average, it will be below 6%. So based on that assumption, when is the next cycle of rate cuts that you are expecting?
Well, no more rate cuts as of now, because you see, the target is 4. The upper limit is 6.
Yeah, yeah.
While we think it will be under 6, it will definitely be above 4. You know, we are thinking more of inflation in the 5.5% terrain. So no space for rate cuts. In fact, quite the opposite, Arup. We think over time, very gradually, the RBI will start absorbing back all this excess liquidity that it has, you know, given through 2020. In fact, it took the first step last week on Friday, you know, where it announced some variable rate reverse repo auctions. And in the commentary, it said, you know, that these are steps towards normalization. So I think normalization is going to be a theme in 2021, you know, as far as RBI is concerned.
All right. With that, we come to an end to this episode of Money Control Macro Minutes. Praju Bhandari, thank you so much for being with us and for taking time out and for speaking with us on various issues and also expectations from the upcoming budget. Thank you, and you have a great day.
Pleasure to be in your show, Arup.